Chapter 63. I knew Oren had to have heard every word of my fight with Libby, but I was also fairly certain he wouldn't comment on it. "I'm still looking for the Davenport," I said tersely. If I'd needed the distraction before, it was downright mandatory now. Without Libby to explore with me, I couldn't bring myself to just keep wandering from room to room. We already checked the old man's office. Where else would someone keep a Davenport desk? I concentrated on that question, not my fight with Libby. Not what I'd said. And what she hadn't. "I have it on good authority," I told Oren after a moment. "That Hawthorne house has multiple libraries." I let out a long, slow breath. "Got any idea where they are?" 2 hours and 4 libraries later, I was standing in the middle of number 5. It was on the second floor. The ceiling was slanted, the walls were lined with built-in shelves, each shelf exactly tall enough for a row of paperback books. The books on the shelves were well-worn, and they covered every inch of the walls, except for a large stained-glass window on the east side. Light shone through, painting colors on the wood floor. No Davenport. This was starting to feel useless. This trail hadn't been laid for me. Tobias Hawthorne's puzzle hadn't been designed with me in mind. I need Jameson. I cut that thought off at the knees, exited the library, and retreated downstairs. I'd counted at least 5 different staircases in this house. This one spiraled, and as I walked down it, the sound of piano music beckoned from a distance. I followed it, and Oren followed me. I came to the entryway of a large open room. The far wall was filled with arches. Beneath each arch was a massive window. Every window was open. There were paintings on the walls, and positioned between them was the biggest grand piano I'd ever seen. Nan sat at the piano's bench, her eyes closed. I thought the old woman was playing, until I walked closer and realized the piano was playing itself. My shoes made a sound against the floor, and her eyes flew open. "I'm sorry," I said. "Hush," Nan commanded. Her eyes closed again. The playing continued, building to a crashing crescendo, and then silence. "Did you know that you can listen to concerts on this thing?" Nan opened her eyes and reached for her cane. With no small amount of effort, she stood. Somewhere in the world, a master plays, and with the push of a button, the keys move here. Her eyes lingered on the piano, an almost wistful expression on her face. "Do you play?" I asked. Nan harumphed. "I did when I was young. Got a bit too much attention for it, and my husband broke my fingers. Put an end to that." The way she said it, no muss, no fuss, was almost as jarring as the words. "That's horrible," I said fiercely. Nan looked at the piano, then at her gnarled, bird-boned hand. She lifted her chin and stared out the massive windows. "He met with a tragic accident not long after that." It sounded an awful lot like Nan had arranged for that accident. She killed her husband? "Nan," a voice scolded from the doorway, "you're scaring the kid." Nan sniffed. "She scares that easy, she won't last here." With that, Nan made her way from the room. The oldest Hawthorne brother turned his attention to me. "You tell your sister you're playing delinquent today?" The mention of Libby had me flashing back to our argument. She's talking to Dad. She didn't want a restraining order against Drake. She won't block him. I wondered how much of that Nash already knew. "Libby knows where I am," I told him stiffly. He gave me a look. "This ain't easy for her, kid. You're at the eye of the storm where things are calm. She's taking the brunt of it, from all sides." I wouldn't call getting shot at calm. "What are your intentions toward my sister?" I asked Nash. He clearly found my line of questioning amusing. "What are your intentions toward Jameson?" "Was there no one in this house who didn't know about the kiss?" "You were right about your grandfather's game," I told Nash. "He tried to warn me. He told me exactly why Jameson had been keeping me close." "Usually am." Nash hooked his thumbs through his belt loops. "The closer to the end you come, the worse it'll get." The logical thing to do was stop playing, step back. But I wanted answers, and some part of me, the part that had grown up with a mom who'd turned everything into a challenge, the part who'd played my first game of chess when I was 6 years old, wanted to win. "Any chance you know where your grandfather might have stashed a Davenport desk?" I asked Nash. He snorted. "You don't learn easy, do you, kid?" I shrugged. Nash considered my question, then cocked his head to the side. "You check the libraries?" "The circular library, the onyx one, the one with the stained glass window, the one with the globes, the maze." I glanced over at my bodyguard. "That's it?" Oren nodded. Nash cocked his head to the side. "Not quite," Chapter 64. Nash led me up two sets of stairs, down three hallways, and past a doorway that had been bricked shut. "What's that?" I asked. He slowed momentarily. "That was my uncle's wing. The old man had it walled off when Toby died." "Because that's normal," I thought. "About as normal as disinheriting your whole family for 20 years and never saying a word." Nash picked up the pace again, and finally we came to a steel door that looked like it belonged on a safe. There was a combination dial, and below it, a 5-pronged lever. Nash casually twirled the dial, left, right, left, too quick for me to catch the numbers. There was a loud clicking sound, and then he turned the lever. The steel door opened out into the hall. What kind of library needs that kind of My brain was in the process of finishing that thought when Nash stepped through the doorway, and I realized what lay beyond wasn't a single room. It was a whole other wing. "The old man started construction on this part of the house when I was born," Nash informed me. The hallway around us was papered with dials, keypads, locks, and keys, all affixed to the walls like art. "Hawthorns learn how to wield a lockpick young," Nash told me, as we walked down the hall. I looked in a room to my left, and there was a small airplane. Not a toy, an actual, single-person airplane. "This was your playroom?" I asked, eyeing the doors lining the rest of the hall, and wondering what surprises these rooms held. "Skye was 17 when I was born," Nash shrugged. "She made an attempt at playing parent. Didn't stick. The old man tried to compensate." "By building you this." "Come on." Nash led me toward the end of the hall and opened another door. "Arcade," he told me, the explanation completely unnecessary. There was a foosball table, a bar, 3 pinball machines, an entire wall of arcade-style consoles. I walked over to one of the pinball machines, pressed a button, and it surged to life. I glanced back at Nash. "I can wait," he said. I should have stayed focused. He was leading me to the final library, and possibly the location of the Davenport, and the next clue. But one game wouldn't kill me. I gave a preliminary flip of the flipper, then launched the ball. I didn't come anywhere near the top score, but when the game was over, it prompted me for my initials anyway. And when I entered them, a familiar message flashed across the screen. "Welcome to Hawthorne House, Avery Kylie Grahams." It was the same message I'd gotten at the bowling alley, and just as I had then, I felt the ghost of Tobias Hawthorne all around me. "Even if you thought you'd manipulated our grandfather into this, I guarantee he'd be the one manipulating you." Nash walked behind the bar. "Refrigerator is full of sugary drinks. What's your poison?" I came closer and saw that he wasn't kidding when he said full. Glass bottles lined every shelf of the fridge, with soda in every imaginable flavor. "Cotton candy?" I wrinkled my nose. "Prickly pear? Bacon and jalapeno?" "I was 6 when Gray was born," Nash said, like that was an explanation. "The old man unveiled this room the day my new little brother came home." He twisted off the top of a suspiciously green soda and took a swig. "I was 7 for Jamie, 8.5 for Xander." He paused, as if weighing my worth as his audience. Aunt Zara and her first husband were having trouble conceiving. Skye would leave for a few months, come back pregnant, wash, rinse, and repeat. That might have been the most messed up thing I'd ever heard. "You want one?" Nash asked, nodding toward the fridge. I wanted to take about 10 of them, but settled for cookies and cream. I glanced back at Oren, who had been playing my silent shadow the whole time. He gave no indication that I should avoid drinking, so I twisted off the cap and took a swig. "The library?" I reminded Nash. "Almost there." Nash pushed through to the next room. "Game room," he said. At the center of the room, there were 4 tables. One table was rectangular, 1 square, 1 oval, 1 circular. The tables were black. The rest of the room, walls, floor, and shelves, were white. The shelves were built into 3 of the room's 4 walls. Not bookshelves, I realized. They held games. Hundreds, maybe thousands, of board games. Unable to resist, I went up to the closest shelf and ran my fingers along the boxes. I never even heard of most of these games. "The old man," Nash said softly, "was a bit of a collector." I was in awe. How many afternoons had my mom and I spent playing garage sale board games? Our rainy day tradition had involved setting up 3 or 4 and turning them all into 1 massive game. But this? These were games from all over the world. Half of them didn't even have English writing on the boxes. I suddenly pictured all 4 Hawthorne brothers sitting around one of those tables, grinning, trash-talking, outmaneuvering each other, wrestling for control, possibly literally. I pushed that thought back. I'd come here looking for the Davenport, the next clue. That was the current game. Not anything held in these boxes. The library? I asked Nash, tearing my eyes away from the games. He nodded toward the end of the room, the one wall that wasn't covered in board games. There was no door. Instead, there was a fire pole and what appeared to be bottom of some kind of chute. A slide? Where's the library? I asked. Nash came to stand beside the fire pole and tilted his head up toward the ceiling. Up there. Chapter 65. Orin went up first, then returned, via pole, not slide. Room's clear, he told me, but if you try to climb up, you might pull a stitch. The fact that he'd mentioned my injury in front of Nash told me something. Either Orin wanted to see how he would respond, or he trusted Nash Hawthorne. What injury? Nash asked, taking the bait. Someone shot at Avery, Orin said carefully. You wouldn't happen to know anything about that, would you, Nash? If I did, Nash replied, his voice low and deadly, it would already be handled. Nash? Orin gave him a look that probably meant, stay out of it. But from what I'd been able to tell, staying out of it wasn't really a Hawthorne trait. I'll be going now, Nash said casually. I have some questions to ask my people. His people, including Melly. I watched Nash saunter off, then turned back to Orin. You knew he would go talk to the staff. I know they'll talk to him, Orin corrected. And besides, you blew the element of surprise this morning. I told Grayson. He'd told his mother. Libby knew. Sorry about that, I said, and then I turned to the room overhead. I'm going up. I didn't see a desk up there, Orin told me. I walked over to the pole and grabbed hold. I'm going up anyway. I started to pull myself up, but the pain stopped me. Orin was right. I couldn't climb. I stepped back from the pole, then glanced to my left. If I couldn't make it up the pole, it would have to be the slide. The last library in Hawthorne House was small. The ceiling sloped to form a pyramid overhead. The shelves were plain and only came up to my waist. They were full of children's books, well-worn, well-loved, some of them familiar in a way that made me ache to sit and read. But I didn't, because as I stood there, I felt a breeze. It wasn't coming from the window, which was closed. It came from the shelves on the back wall. No. As I walked closer, I discovered that it was coming from a crack between the two shelves. There's something back there. My heart caught like a breath stuck in my throat. Starting with the shelf on the right, I latched my fingers around the top of the shelf and pulled. I didn't have to pull hard. The shelf was on a hinge. As I pulled, it rotated outward, revealing a small opening. This is the first secret passage I'd discovered on my own. It was strangely exhilarating, like standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon or holding a priceless work of art in your hands. Heart pounding, I ducked through the opening and found a staircase. Traps upon traps, I thought, and riddles upon riddles. Gingerly, I walked down the steps. As I got farther from the light above, I had to pull out my phone and turn on the flashlight so I could see where I was going. I should go back for Orin. I knew that, but I was going faster now, down the steps, twisting, turning, until I reached the bottom. There, holding a flashlight of his own, was Grayson Hawthorne. He turned toward me. My heart beat viciously, but I didn't step back. I looked past Grayson and saw the only piece of furniture on the landing of the hidden stairs. A Davenport. Ms. Grahams? Grayson greeted me, then turned back to the desk. Have you found it yet? I asked him. The Davenport clue? I was waiting. I couldn't quite read his tone. For what? Grayson looked up from the desk, silver eyes catching mine in the dark. Jameson, I suppose. It had been hours since Jameson had left for school, hours since I'd seen Grayson last. How long had he been here, waiting? It's not like Jamie to miss the obvious. Whatever this game is, it's about us, the four of us. Our names were the clues. Of course we would find something here. At the bottom of the staircase, I asked. In our wing, Grayson replied. We grew up here, Jameson, Xander, and me. Nash, too, I suppose, but he was older. I remembered Xander telling me that Jameson and Grayson used to team up to beat Nash to the finish line, then double-cross each other at the end of the game. Nash knows about the shooting, I told Grayson. I told him. Grayson gave me a look I couldn't quite discern. What? I said. Grayson shook his head. I want to save you now. Is that such a bad thing? I asked. Another look, and more emotion, heavily masked. Will you show me where you were hurt? Grayson asked, his voice not quite strained, but something. He probably just wants to see how bad it is, I told myself, but still, the request hit me like an electric shock. My limbs felt inexplicably heavy. I was keenly aware of each breath I took. This was a small space. We stood close to each other, close to the desk. I'd learned my lesson with Jameson, but this felt different. Like Grayson wanted to be the one to save me, like he needed to be the one. I lifted my hand to the collar of my shirt. I pulled it downward, below my collarbone, exposing my wound. Grayson lifted his hand toward my shoulder. I am sorry that happened to you. Do you know who shot at me? I had to ask, because he'd apologized, and Grayson Hawthorne was not the type to apologize. If he knew... No, Grayson swore. I believed him, or at least I wanted to. If I leave Hawthorne House before the year is up, the money goes to charity. If I die, it goes to charity or my heirs. I paused. If I die, the foundation goes to the four of you. He had to know how that looked. My grandfather should have left it to us all along, Grayson turned his head, forcefully pulling his gaze from my skin. Or to Zara. We were raised to make a difference, and you... I'm nobody, I finished, the words hurting me to say. Grayson shook his head. I don't know what you are. Even in the minimal light of our flashlights, I could see his chest rising and falling with every breath. Do you think Jameson's right? I asked him. Does this puzzle of your grandfather's end with answers? It ends with something. The old man's games always do. Grayson paused. How many of the numbers do you have? 2, I replied. Same, he told me. I'm missing this one and Xander's. I frowned. Xander's? Blackwood. It's Xander's middle name. The Westbrook was Nash's clue. The Winchester was Jameson's. I looked back toward the desk. And the Davenport is yours. He closed his eyes. After you, Eris. His use of Jameson's nickname for me felt like it meant something, but I wasn't sure what. I turned my attention to the task at hand. The desk was made of a bronze-colored wood. 4 drawers ran perpendicular to the desktop. I tested them one at a time. Empty. I ran my right hand along the inside of the drawers, looking for anything out of the ordinary. Nothing. Feeling Grayson's presence beside me, knowing that I was being watched and judged, I moved on to the top of the desk, raising it up to reveal the compartment underneath. Empty again. As I had with drawers, I ran my fingers along the bottom and sides of the compartment. I felt a slight ridge along the right side. Eyeballing the desk, I estimated the width of the border to be 1.5 inches, maybe 2 inches. Just wide enough for a hidden compartment. Unsure how to trigger its release, I ran my hand back over the place where I'd felt the ridge. Maybe it was just a seam where 2 pieces of wood met. Or maybe. I pressed the wood in hard, and it popped outward. I closed my fingers around the block that it had released and pulled it away from the desk, revealing a small opening. Inside was a keychain with no key. The keychain was plastic in the shape of the number 1. Chapter 66. 8-1-1. I slept in Libby's room again that night. She didn't. I asked Orin to confirm with her security team that she was okay on the premises. She was, but he didn't tell me where. No Libby, no Max. I was alone. More alone than I'd been since I got here. No Jameson. I hadn't seen him since he'd left that morning. No Grayson. He hadn't lingered with me for long after we'd discovered the clue. 118. That was all I had to concentrate on. 3 numbers which confirmed for me that Toby's tree in the Blackwood had just been a tree. If there was a 4th number, it was still out there. Based on that keychain, the clue in the Blackwood could appear in any format, not just a carving. Late into the night and nearly asleep, I heard something like footsteps. Behind me? Below? The wind whistled outside my window. Gunshots lurked in my memory. I had no idea what was lurking in the walls. I didn't fall asleep until dawn. When I did, I dreamed about sleeping. I have a secret, my mom says, cheerfully bouncing onto my bed, jarring me awake. Care to make a guess, my newly 15-year-old daughter? I'm not playing, I grumble, pulling the covers back over my head. I never guessed right. I'll give you a hint, my mom wheedles, for your birthday. She pulls the covers back and flops down beside me on my pillow. Her smile is contagious. I finally break and smile back. Fine, give me a hint. I have a secret about the day you were born. I woke with a headache to my lawyer throwing open the plantation shutters. Rise and shine, Elisa said, with the force and surety of a person making an argument in court. Go away. Channeling my younger self, I pulled the covers over my head. My apologies, Elisa said, not sounding apologetic in the least. But you really do have to get up now. I don't have to do anything, I muttered. I'm a billionaire. That worked about as well as I expected it to. If you'll recall, Elisa replied pleasantly, in an attempt to do damage control after your impromptu press conference earlier this week, I arranged for your debut in Texas society to take place this weekend. There is a charity benefit that you'll be attending this evening. I barely slept last night, I tried for pity. Someone tried to shoot me. We'll get you some vitamin C and a pain pill. Elisa was without mercy. I'm taking you dress shopping in half an hour. You have media training at 1, hair and makeup at 4. Maybe we should reschedule, I said, due to someone wanting to kill me. Warren signed off on us leaving the estate. Elisa gave me a look. You have 29 minutes. She eyed my hair. Make sure you're looking your best. I'll meet you at the car. Chapter 67. Warren escorted me to the SUV. Elisa and two of his men were waiting inside it, and they weren't the only ones. I know you weren't planning on going shopping without me, Thea said, by way of greeting. Where there are high fashion boutiques, so there is Thea. I looked toward Orin, hoping he'd kick her out of the car. He didn't. Besides, Thea told me in a haughty little whisper as she buckled her seatbelt, we need to talk about Rebecca. The SUV had 3 rows of seats. Orin and a second bodyguard sat in the front. Elisa and the third sat in the back. Thea and I were in the middle. What did you do to Rebecca? Thea waited until she was satisfied that the other occupants of the car weren't listening too closely before she asked the question, low and under her breath. I didn't do anything to Rebecca. I will accept that you didn't fall into the Jameson Hawthorne trap for the purpose of dredging up memories of Jameson and Emily. Thea clearly thought she was being magnanimous. But that's where my generosity ends. Rebecca's painfully beautiful. But the girl cries ugly. I know what she looks like when she's spent all night crying. Whatever her deal is, this isn't just about Jameson. What happened at the cottage? Rebecca knows about the shooting. She was forbidden from telling anyone. I tried to wrap my mind around the implications. Why was she crying? Speaking of Jameson, Thea changed tactics. He is oh so clearly miserable, and I can only assume I owe that to you. He's miserable? I felt something flicker in my chest, a what if, but I quelled it. Why do you hate him so much? I asked Thea. Why don't you? Why are you even here? I narrowed my eyes. Not in this car, I amended, before she could mention high fashion boutiques. At Hawthorne House. What did Zara and your uncle ask you to come here to do? Why stick so close to me? What did they want? What makes you think they asked me to do anything? It was obvious in Thea's tone and in her manner that she was a person who'd been born with the upper hand and never lost it. There's a first time for everything, I thought. But before I could lay out my case, the car pulled up to the boutique, and the paparazzi circled us in a deafening, claustrophobic crunch. I slumped back in my seat. I have an entire mall in my closet. I shot Elisa an aggravated look. If I just wore something I already have, we wouldn't have to deal with this. This, Elisa echoed as Orin got out of the car, and the roar of the reporter's questions grew louder, is the point. I was here to be seen, to control the narrative. Smile pretty, Thea murmured directly into my ear. The boutique Elisa had chosen for this carefully choreographed outing was the kind of store that only had 1 copy of each dress. They'd closed the entire shop down for me. Green, Thea pulled an evening gown from the rack. Emerald, to match your eyes. My eyes are hazel, I said flatly. I turned from the dress she was holding to the sales attendant. Do you have anything less low-cut? You prefer higher cuts? The sales attendant's tone was so carefully non-judgmental that I was almost certain she was judging me. Something that covers my collarbone, I said, and then I shot a look at Elisa. And my stitches. You heard, Miss Grams, Elisa said firmly, and Thea is right. Bring us something green. Chapter 68. We found a dress. The paparazzi snapped their pictures as Oren ushered the lot of us back into the SUV. As we pulled away from the curb, he glanced in the rearview mirror. Seatbelts buckled? Mine was. Beside me, Thea fastened hers. Have you thought about hair and makeup? She asked. Constantly, I replied in a deadpan. These days, I think of literally nothing else. A girl has to have her priorities in order. Thea smiled. And here I was thinking your priorities all had the last name Hawthorne. That's not true, I said. But isn't it? How much time had I spent thinking about them? How badly had I wanted Jameson to mean it when he told me I was special? How clearly could I still feel Grayson checking my wound? Your bodyguard didn't want me to come today, Thea murmured as we turned into a long and winding road. Neither did your lawyer. I persevered, and do you know why? Not a clue. This has nothing to do with my uncle or Zara. Thea played with the tips of her dark hair. I'm just doing what Emily would want me to do. Remember that, would you? Without warning, the car swerved. My body kicked into panic mode, fight or flight, and neither one of them was an option, strapped into the back seat. I whipped my head toward Oren, who was driving, and noticed that the guard in the passenger seat had his hand on his gun, vigilant, ready. Something's wrong. We shouldn't have come. I shouldn't have trusted even for a moment that I was safe. Elisa pushed this. She wanted me out here. Hold tight, Oren yelled. What's going on? I asked. The words lodged themselves in my throat and came out as a whisper. I saw a flash of movement out of my window, a car jerking toward us, high speed. I screamed. My subconscious was screaming at me to run. Oren swerved again, enough to prevent full-scale impact, but I heard the screech of metal on metal. Someone is trying to run us off the road. Oren laid on the gas. The sound of sirens, police sirens, barely broke through the cacophony of panic in my head. This can't be happening. Please don't let this be happening. Please, no. Oren roared into the left lane, ahead of the car that attacked us. He swung the SUV around, up and over the median, sending us racing in the opposite direction. I tried to scream, but it wasn't loud or shrill. I was keening, and I couldn't make it stop. There was more than one siren now. I turned toward the back of the car, expecting the worst, preparing for impact. And I saw the car that had us spinning out. Within seconds, the vehicle was surrounded by cops. We're okay, I whispered. I didn't believe it. My body was still telling me that I would never be okay again. Oren eased off the gas, but he didn't stop, and he didn't turn around. What the hell was that? I asked, my voice high enough in a pitch and volume to crack glass. That, Oren replied calmly, was someone taking the bait. The bait? I swung my gaze toward Elisa. What is he talking about? In the heat of the moment, I thought that it was Elisa's fault that we were here. I doubted her, but Oren's response suggested that maybe I should have blamed them both. This, Elisa said, her trademark calm dented but not destroyed, was the point. That was the same thing she'd said when we'd seen the paparazzi outside the boutique. Paparazzi, making sure we were seen. The absolute need to come dress shopping, despite everything that happened. Because of everything that happened. You used me as bait? I wasn't a yeller, but I was yelling now. Beside me, Thea recovered her voice, and then some. What the hell is going on here? Oren exited the highway and slowed to a stop at a red light. Yes, he told me apologetically, we used you, and ourselves, as bait. He glanced toward Thea and answered her question. There was an attack on Avery 2 days ago. Our friends at the police station agreed to play this my way. You could have killed us. I couldn't make my heart stop pounding. I could barely breathe. We had backup, Oren assured me. My people, as well as the police. I won't tell you that you weren't in danger, but the situation being what it was, danger was not a possibility that could be eliminated. There were no good options. You had to continue living in the house. Instead of waiting for another attack, Elisa and I engineered what looked like a prime opportunity. Now, maybe we can get some answers. First they told me that the Hawthorns weren't a threat. Then they'd used me to flush out the threat. You could have told me, I said roughly. It was better, Elisa told me, that you didn't know, that no one knew. Better for whom? Before I could say that, Oren got a call. Did Rebecca know about the attack? Thea asked beside me. Is that why she's been so upset? Oren. Elisa ignored Thea and me. Did they apprehend the driver? They did. Oren paused, and I caught him looking at me in the rearview mirror, his eyes softening in a way that made my stomach twist. Avery, it was your sister's boyfriend. Drake. Ex-boyfriend, I corrected, my voice getting caught in my throat. Oren didn't respond to my assertion. They found a rifle in his trunk that, at least preliminarily, matches the bullets. The police will be wanting to talk to your sister. What? I said, my heart still banging mercilessly at my ribcage. Why? On some level, I knew. I knew the answer to that question, but I couldn't accept it. I wouldn't. If Drake was the shooter, someone would have had to let him onto the estate, Elisa said, her voice uncharacteristically gentle. Not Libby, I thought. Libby wouldn't. Avery. Elisa put a hand on my shoulder. If something happens to you, even without a will, your sisters and your father are your heirs. Chapter 69. These were the facts. Drake had tried to run my car off the road. He had a weapon that was likely match for a bullets Oren had recovered. He had a felony record. The police took my statement. They asked questions about the shooting, about Drake, about Libby. Eventually, I was escorted back to Hawthorne House. The front door flew open before Elisa and I had even made it to the porch. Nash stormed out of the house, then slowed when he saw us. You want to tell me why I'm just now getting word that the police hauled Libby out of here? He asked Elisa. I'd never heard a southern drawl sound quite like that. Elisa lifted her chin. If she's not under arrest, she has no obligation to go with them. She doesn't know that, Nash boomed. Then he lowered his voice and looked her in the eye. If you'd wanted to protect her, you could have. There were so many layers to that sentence. I couldn't begin to untangle them, not with my brain focused on other things. Libby. The police have Libby. I'm not in the business of protecting every sad story that comes along, Elisa told Nash. I knew she wasn't just talking about Libby, but that didn't matter. She's not a sad story, I gritted out. She's my sister. And, more likely than not, an accessory to attempted murder. Elisa reached out to touch my shoulder. I stepped back. Libby wouldn't hurt me. She wouldn't let anyone hurt me. I believed that, but I couldn't say it. Why couldn't I say it? That bastard's been texting her, Nash said beside me. I've been trying to get her to block him, but she feels so damn guilty. For what? Elisa pushed. What does she feel guilty for? If she's got nothing to hide from the police, then why are you so concerned about her talking to them? Nash's eyes flashed. You're really going to stand there and act like we weren't both raised to treat never talk to the authorities without a lawyer present like a commandment? I thought about Libby alone in a cell. She probably wasn't even in the cell, but I couldn't shake the image. Send someone, I told Elisa shakily, from the firm. She opened her mouth to object, and I cut her off. Do it. I might not hold the purse strings now, but I would someday. She worked for me. Consider it done, Elisa said, and leave me alone. I told her fiercely. She and Oren had kept me in the dark. They'd move me around like a chess piece on a board. All of you, I said, turning back to Oren. I needed to be alone. I needed to do everything in my power to keep them from planning even a seed of doubt, because if I couldn't trust Libby, I had no one. Nash cleared his throat. You want to tell her about that media consultant waiting in the sitting room, Lily, or should I?